First and foremost, just Yasher Koach to Mishkov's for sponsoring the spread for this morning. It was delicious. We're observing the yard site, 17th yard site, right, in front of your father. Milton Sprung, Moshe Ben Yishai Aleib. So the learning that we do this morning should be his foot for his Adiyat Neshama, and he should remain in your collective family's hearts for many years to come. Okay, so last week, thank you, Michael. Last week we were discussing the concept of Tzionut pretty much from the dawn of time. And this is an idea that I was developing, I'm particularly fond of, about how the concept of the Am HaNivchar in Eretz Yisrael, as we presented, is really ultimately was the plan from the very beginning. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, after Gan Eden didn't work, right? And he acknowledged ki yitzer lev ha'adam raminu rav, that man is evil and is incapable of a sustained type of ideal existence, so therefore he needed to do an about-face and a new plan. And that new plan was to place a chosen people in a land that basically required them to be dependent. And we read through all of the Nevuot, many of the Nevuot of Sefer Bereishit, and then several of the, we looked at very quickly, we looked at the breakdown of Taryag Mitzvot, and then we looked at some of the Nevuot of Shivat Zion and of Churban, all of which have this very significant emphasis on other peoples, which on the surface is a little bit strange if we're talking about the concept of an Am HaNivchar, of a chosen people, being chosen and put in this promised land, why there's such a significant preoccupation with other peoples. And what we suggested then was that the reason why there's such this preoccupation with other peoples is because the focus of the plan was for Am Yisrael to be living in Eretz Yisrael as a model for other people. That's ultimately what HaKadosh Baruch Hu did. And that while we, Am Yisrael is the Am HaNivchar, that doesn't mean that we are better necessarily. It doesn't mean that the Jewish people are better. It just means that they have a specific a role to serve. The entire world is supposed to be looking. We looked a little bit at the geography of the surrounding lands of Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael is on a mountain, the other things are lower. And Ki'ilu, you're actually looking up, literally, at this land, and it's supposed to be this model. Things eventually go wrong. Why? What does Hashem say time and time again? We say it in Kriya Shema every day. We say it. It's Nevuah after Nevuah on Tanakh. What is ultimately the sustaining of this plan dependent on? Yeah. The mitzvot that HaKadosh Baruch Hu sets up, like, as we suggested last week, I think they're supposed to be there to, in order to maintain dependence. But in addition to that, they're there on we're there on a meritocracy. The only way this plan is going to be able to be sustained is if we follow the rules. And if we don't follow the rules, everything falls apart. Now, there's the basic schar va'onesh approach to why that is the case. All right, and you can understand why. God tells us to do something. He tells us that if we don't do it, we're going to get punished. But I think there's also another approach to take to the plan not working. And that's just the notion of action and consequence. The only way that the plan works is if the Am HaNivchar acts like an Am HaNivchar. If they don't act that way, they're not acting like a model nation that's supposed to be a light onto the other nations. If they're not doing that, then the plan's worthless to begin with. So it's not just that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is punishing the Jewish people when they're not following the right path. It's that they don't serve their purpose anymore, and therefore they have no function being where they are, establishing a monarchy, establishing a government in Eretz Yisrael. So that's essentially how I'd like to lead up to our discussion today. Volume 2 of this discussion is going to be about Chazal and how they perceive Zionism. Now, my original plan for this was going to be to actually speak of discuss a lot of Ma'amari Chazal that have to deal with Eretz Yisrael. But I was putting them together, and I'm realizing that a lot of this stuff many of us are familiar with, and it's a shir that I'm sure in some respect many of us have heard before. So I kind of shifted gears, and what I decided to do today, what we decided to spend our time with this morning, is to actually speak about the historical context of Chazal and the historical lead-up to where Chazal are. And see if we can paint a picture of who Chazal were and what their attitudes were towards the land, towards the government, towards self-rule, based on the historical factors that are manifest in the end of Tanakh, and then leading forward with the history of the latter half of Bayit Sheni. Okay, so that's kind of what I'd like to do today. So we're going to start a couple centuries before Chazal. Now, everybody, I hope everybody have a sheet? It's a little bit messy. Basically what it is, and it's pretty simple, we're going to go through everything. The middle is just a timeline. It's not proportional, but it's the idea is that it's a timeline. And we're going to be going through several dates. And you'll see the lines go towards the stuff that we want to talk about. So in the box with just the English, that's a historical moment. And then if there's a makor attached to it, if there's a text attached to it, that's a text that's nogeya, that's related to that historical moment. Okay, so let's go through them. And let's, again, as is always the case, if anybody has any questions, if anybody has any comments, if anybody has a different read on something that we're looking at, I encourage and I insist that you speak up. Okay? So let's start with, I picked this here because I didn't want to just start with Churban Bayis Rishon. I thought maybe a little bit of a lead up to it because I think the lead up to it is relevant. One of the salient themes really throughout a large part of Tanakh, a large part of the end of Bayis Rishon as things are starting to unravel, is the involvement of other governments, other foreign rulers, foreign lands. Okay? We said this last week. We're this little people in a little land surrounded by great empires, with great armies. That factors in terms of, like, just think about how things work today. The geopolitics of trying to run Eretz Yisrael, two, 3,000 years ago, that is very much relevant. And that actually is manifest in Tanakh. So in 605, right, this is not a Jewish event. In 605, there's a major battle fought between Babel and Egypt. Egypt are the two powers vying for control of the Middle East. It's not all that different of things that we see today. There's these two great powers, and Babel, led by Nebuchadnezzar, right? He's actually the second person by that name, but he's the notorious villain from our history. So Nebuchadnezzar defeats the Egyptian army at Carchemish. Okay, so we'll look at source number one right here. This is a psukim in Yirmiyahu that are referring to foreign battles that took place not immediately relevant to Am Yisrael. Asher hayad var Hashem al Yirmiyahu anavi al agoyim. This was said to Yirmiyahu regarding other nations. L'mitzrayim al chel paro necho. Paro necho, who was the paro, who was the pharaoh of Mitzrayim at the time. Asher haya al nahar perat b'Carchemish. Right, he fought this great battle on Carchemish, this place in it's around in Turkish area, southern Turkey right now. And I think Asher hikam Nebuchadnezzar melech Babel. So this was this great defeat suffered by Paro and Egypt, the Egyptian armies, by Babel. This is in the year 605 BC. Now I'm going to make one disclaimer. Most of the dates that I'm putting here are subject to question. I'm trying to paint a picture, so I put them here, and I didn't put parentheses. This person thinks this, or this person thinks that. So you get it. If I'm 100 years off, just know that there are people that question these dates. But we're, again, just for the sake of continuity. So in 605 BCE, Babel conquers and wins a big battle against Egypt. Now that has immediate consequences. All right. Egypt, right, and if you read through Sefer Yirmiyahu, this is actually something that Yirmiyahu warns significantly against. But Egypt ends up at this point is an ally of Malchut Yehuda. Alright? And what happens when you're a small country and you have a big ally, and the big ally is defeated by somebody else? So now you start to worry, right? Am I safe? Am I teaming up with the right person? So that's essentially what was going on in 605 when the Egyptian armies got this big defeat by Babel. So a few years later already, basically what happens is that Nebuchadnezzar comes in and he takes control of the monarchy in Malchut Yehuda. All right, and Yehoiakim, who's the king at the time, he starts paying tribute to. Right. As soon as this battle is done, Yehoiakim HaMelech starts paying tribute to Babel instead of Mitzrayim. Okay, stick with me here. So that's what happens. Now Nebuchadnezzar, who is he's living large because he just won this big battle. A few years later, he marches down and tries to invade Egypt. Right, I did it in Carchemish. I can now do it in Egypt. So he leads his army down to Egypt and he's unsuccessful. So now, in the interim, in those few years of the interim, Yehoiakim has now started paying tribute. Basically, switched sides. He's now allied with Babel instead of Mitzrayim.
But now, Bavel goes down, tries to beat Mitzrayim, and now Bavel gets beaten again, gets beaten back. Okay, so this is a lot of the stuff that if you read through Sefer Yirmiyahu, that Yirmiyahu is warning against, of getting entangled in these foreign wars, these foreign alliances, because it's just going to lead to nowhere. But you can understand the king of a weaker government trying to guarantee the future of his people. So you understand the allure to doing it, but they didn't listen to the Navi ultimately, and as a result, so now they're once again they find themselves on the wrong side. So what happens? The Yehoyakim HaMelech sees this defeat, and he says, okay, this is our chance, now we can finally be independent. Right? Source number two, we're in Malachim Ben. Ben Esir Mechamesh Shana Yehoyakim B'malcho, V'achat Esrei Shana Malach Yerushalayim. Alright, now we're in part the beginning of Parak of Dalet. Yamav Alan Nebuchadnezzar Melech Bavel, Vayihilo Yehoyakim Eved Shalosh Shanim, Vayashava Yimradlo. Alright, so this is the 3 years of his being an Eved. Yehoyakim is a reference to switching alliances and paying tribute. Right? There's a lot of it's amazing how historically accurate a lot of these Pesukim in Tanakh are. We have corroborating sources from Babylonian histories. Tablets and there's tons of stuff in the British Museum that actually corresponds to this. So Yehoyakim switches sides, and then he gets beaten, and now he tries to declare independence. All right. So as we all know, Nebuchadnezzar doesn't like that. Okay, and we get into big trouble. Right, the Malchut Yehuda gets into big trouble because it's this little small nation who thinks that this is their opportunity to break free. And in response to the rebellion, all right, Nebuchadnezzar lays siege. He marches in 597, and he lays siege to Yerushalayim. What does he do? All right, Yehoyakim, who's supposed to be paying tribute to Babel, he tosses him, and he installs Tzidkiyahu HaMelech to be his successor. And this is the first of a long string of vassal monarchs of just puppet rulers that Am Yisrael that is appointed over the Jewish people by foreign rulers. This is a theme that goes on for centuries. So now we have Tzidkiyahu HaMelech, who is now the vassal king of Nebuchadnezzar. After 9 years on the throne, and he's paying tribute to Nebuchadnezzar, all right, and that we don't have to read inside, but that's Malachim Bet in source 3. That's describing that. So after 9 years on the throne, paying tribute to Nebuchadnezzar, you reestablish, right, now we're teamed up with Babel. This gets confusing. Babel, Egypt. But what happens is, he reestablishes his alliance with Mitzrayim for the sole purpose of trying to remove the yoke of Babylonia. Think of the U.S. in the Revolutionary War in 1776. They had no interest in indebting themselves to France. But the only way that they were going to be able to cast off the yoke of Great Britain was to ally with a foreign power. That's essentially what Tzidkiyahu HaMelech is doing here. So he now tries to team up with Egypt. Egypt, who you know, is a much bigger army, much bigger country, and they have no love for Babel. So they think, okay, now's the time, let me team up with Egypt. And then what happens in response? Nebuchadnezzar gets wind of this, and he invades Malchut Yehuda, he besieges Yerushalayim for a second time, and after 30 months of this siege, he breaches the walls, and that ultimately, that first siege starts in 589, 587 BC is when Churban Bayis Rishon happens. Okay? So, and you see these in the Pesukim very quickly. We're in source number 4. Vayimrotz Yitkiyahu b'melech Babel, vayi b'shnat ha-tshi'it, b'malcho b'chodesh ha-siri. Alright? Blah, 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 blah. Nebuchadnezzar melech Babel, hu v'chol chelo al Yerushalayim, v'yichan aleha, v'yivnu aleha dayek saviv. Nebuchadnezzar melech Babel comes, and he surrounds the entire Yerushalayim. V'tzibaka ha'ir. Right? These are very difficult Pesukim to read. Right, he's describing killing the children in cold blood of the king. So this is, so he did some very dastardly things, Nebuchadnezzar, in this siege. But from Nebuchadnezzar's perspective, he's the bigger power. This is supposed to be a government that's paying tribute to him, and all of a sudden they're just trying to fight him off. So that's why he's reacting so harshly. So this is all of the nevuos of Sefer Yirmiyahu, basically foreshadowing the Churban, and saying, "Don't get involved with Mitzrayim. Don't get involved with Bavel. Don't get involved with them, because all you're going to do is get yourself into more trouble." This is all happening, in real time, in these pesukim in Malachim Ben. Okay, so the theme, all right, and the reason why I wanted to start from here, from the Egypt and Babylonian wars, leading up to the Churban, the theme here, the running theme, is that there are lots of foreign powers involved, right? The same way that it is today. The same way that Medina Israel today is now situated in a very rough neighborhood with a lot of much bigger countries that don't wish them very well. All right? It was the same thing. It was the same thing 2,500 years ago. There was these very powerful governments. They expected Am Yisrael, the Malchut Yisrael, the Malchut Yehuda to fall in line, and they didn't. And as a result, you know, the Churban, eventually it's what led to the Churban. Now, keep in mind this theme. Malchut, think about, you know, in the context of what we spoke about last week. We're trying to be, yes, we're trying to be a government, and we're trying to be a people, and we're trying to be wise. All of these Malchut Yehuda were acting in self-interest, and they thought they were doing what was best. But we're also a people that's supposed to be chosen. We also have a divine message. We also have a divine mission. We also have all of these Tayyag mitzvot that are supposed to be fulfilled. Now, when you read these psukim of everything that leads up to the Churban, I can't help but think that it just really gets in the way of everything. Like, it's hard to go to shul in the morning when, you know, you're busy trying to fight off a foreign army. Like, as is the case in any people at war. So the glaringly obvious reality throughout this entire history leading up to Churban Bayis Rishon is that Am Yisrael's dependence and involvement with other peoples, their political activity, their political machinations, get them into trouble. All right. Now, if you're the type of person that wants to be focusing on more religious, more spiritual, more cerebral matters, and you're less of a soldier and you're less of a politician, and you can imagine that throughout this entire process, it was very, you know, it was very difficult for them, and they're thinking in their heads, maybe there's some other way we can do this. Maybe there's some other way that we can go about running a country, running a society, because all we're doing is getting ourselves into trouble. Okay, so that's so that with that we've gone through. Yeah, Elliot.
Is doing something else like just sitting and learning? Is that what?
I don't know. Well, you know, let me say it this way. My entire childhood, this was a question that really bothered me, and I used to be a real nudnik with some of my teachers about it. You don't see this model that we've inherited from the world of the yeshivas and, you know, in the old country, that we were all raised on, that, you know, the optimal religious experience that we can be doing is in being engaged in Talmud Torah and engaged in Devar Hashem. There's so little evidence of that in Tanakh. Virtually none. David HaMelech, the Ne'im Zmirot Yisrael, who is supposed to be all of the, you know, characters in Tanakh, who are supposed to be the highest of the high, of the most elevated level that can be. Chazal certainly understand them to be that way, and they were. And you shouldn't think for a second that I don't believe that they were. Yeah, it was always a question for me about why we don't see evidence of that in Tanakh. Like, why isn't there any evidence of David HaMelech learning morning seder, you know, before going out to rule the people? Like, that was a difficult question for me. Now, I think that they were involved? Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And Torah Shabbat and Torah Shabbat Peh was, and again, I don't mean to say that I think that they weren't. I mean to say that the question I always had was why Tanakh wasn't preoccupied with it. Spiritual matters. There are, and there are many examples, but like I said, you don't see David HaMelech sitting in morning seder and, you know, working over a Tosfos or a Reb Chaim. That's just not what Tanakh is preoccupied with. Tanakh is something else. I mean, I think this is nogea to what we were talking about last week. I think Tanakh has a message. It's not that. I think Torah Shabbat Peh's message was that, and Torah Shabbat Tzav had a very different message. But to answer your question, I think that what subsequently happens in the beginning of Bayis Sheni, what subsequently happens as Chazal now develops, we'll get to in a moment, I think that you know, when I look at that history, I'm thinking that that must be what people were thinking during the Churban. That this is all we're doing is getting ourselves into trouble here. Maybe we should stop trying to play king. We should stop trying to play politics. We should stop trying to play, you know, the smartest ruler in the region. And we should focus on things that we're good at, things that we know that we can do, things that are a little bit less contradictory to the desires of the foreign powers, and things that we might be able to pull off with some measure of success. You'll see where I'm going with this in a second. Okay, so that brings us to Churban Bayis Rishon. Terrible. What happened to Churban Bayis Rishon? We can read through Pesukim. Basically, Nebuchadnezzar, he's trying to undo the religious fabric and the leadership structure in the land, he doesn't exile everybody. He leaves a very significant percentage of the population still in Eretz Yisrael. What he does is he exiles the elite. all of the teachers and all of the rabbanim and all of the leaders and all of the monarchy, all of the monarchs. That's who he sends out. So you basically are left here with a leaderless people. And everybody who's of any significance is in exile. Think about it. Who do we know that are in exile? All of these Nevi'im. Mordechai and Esther are in Galus. Ezra, Nehemiah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. These are all very, very significant people that end up going back. But they're the ones that Nebuchadnezzar sends out. Because he knows. He's a smart guy. And he knows that if I want to undermine the entire fabric of what makes these people tick, right, and they've been a thorn in my side for a long time, I don't need to get everybody, I just need to get their leadership structure. So that's what happens. And it's unfortunately, it's a model that several people have used on the Jewish people over the years.
It's a generalized model that's been used over centuries and many civilizations.
Yeah.
It's not just the leadership.
Hitler attacked Paris, so he didn't have to go after the French army in World War II, he just needed to invade Paris and imprison everyone.
That a little bit more of shining across the Cultural Revolution, where we're taking everybody who's educated, moving them out of the city into the country so they could rebel. Okay. So it's always done, but it's not just done against leadership. Anybody who's skilled was also taken.
Yep.
He's the doctor, he's the workers, everybody who's doing anything was also taken.
Yeah. The Psukim actually talk about this, about how, like, there was nobody who could beat a plowshare in there anymore.
Yeah,
like,
so basically went over to turn the country back a century.
Yeah. So that's what we're left with after Churban Bayis Rishon. So now there are all these talented people, but they're all in Golos. Now, as everybody knows, the Golos bubble doesn't last very long, right? What happens, shortly thereafter? The Battle of Opis. All right, this is in five. We're on the top of page 2. All right, this is just some interesting history, and it actually is referenced in Sefer Ezra. The Battle of Opis is when the Persian army basically beats Babylonia. So Babylonia has this all-powerful empire, and within a few years, in 530, okay, so you could do the math. If 589 BCE was the Churban Bayis, and 539 BCE was the Battle of Opis, which is when the Persian Empire overtook the Babylonian Empire, so we're only talking about 60 years here. Now, it was not only a battle of armies going up against each other, but there was ideologies that was at work here. The Persian Empire had a very different idea of how to control its empire. Babylonia wanted to just subjugate everyone. They wanted to take away the power structure and everywhere, and make sure that everybody was nothing but dependent. The Persian Empire, as we know, because of what ultimately develops, they were much more kind to foreign peoples, the foreign ideologies, the foreign thoughts, the foreign to foreign systems of religion, and they basically the Persian. And this was not the reason I'm saying this is because again, through we have it in Tanakh of Shivas Zion, but it actually was one of several examples of galuyot that the Babylonians created, that the Persians overtook the Babylonians and basically said, okay, you can go back home now. So Ezra and Nehemiah being told that they were allowed to go back to Eretz Yisrael was actually part of the pattern of the Persian Empire. So, we're in source number 5. Ubishnat achat lekoresh melech paras lechlot dvar Hashem ipi Yirmiyahu ha'ir Hashem. All right. This is again. This is all prophesied in Sefer Yirmiyahu that we're going to have a return to Tzion. Right. Adruach koresh melech paras. Hakadosh Baruch Hu stirs up the will of Cyrus the Great. Vayaver kol b'chol malchuto v'gam michtav lemor. He actually wrote an edict. Ko amar koresh melech paras, kol mamlechot haaretz natan li Hashem elokei hashamayim, v'hu bakar alai livnot lo bayit b'yushalayim asher b'yuda. God Almighty has given me all the lands, all of His lands, and He's told me that it's time for us to go build the new Beis HaMikdash. Mi bachem, alright, it's Pasuk Gimel now in Source 5. Mi bachem, mi kol amo yi elokav imo v'yal Yerushalayim asher b'yuda, v'yiven et beit Hashem elokei Yisrael hu elokim asher b'yushalayim. Koresh sends, Cyrus the Great sends out this open edict to anybody who wants, go and build the Beis HaMikdash. Alright? This is, again, this is in Tanakh and it's corroborated in the historical record that this is something that Cyrus the Great was interested in doing. Like I said, in the Persian record it's a pattern that he's doing with lots of peoples. Okay, now, they don't go right away. Ezra doesn't make it for several more years. In the interim is the Purim story, all right. Which again, if you think about it in that context now, then the Persian Empire, right, Mordechai being stuck now, all this foreign people, strange people that had different customs, that had different. Why? Because the entire people moved in one shot. Right? How do you fight cultural diffusion? How do you fight assimilation? It's the hardest way to do it is for people to go piecemeal. Right? This guy from this shtetl goes and he moves to Cincinnati. And this guy from, and the two families from this shtetl, they move and they go to Chicago. And this family from this shtetl, they move. And that's not a way to keep a culture alive. But if you have a mass migration of people and they all set up shop in the same spot, right? This happened in the community that I grew up in. So in 1979 was the Iranian Revolution, and a huge percentage of the country's Jews got up and left and came here. Right? A lot went to Israel, a lot went to here. And a huge number of them all, like within 2 years, bought houses in Roslyn, where I grew up. And it was fascinating. I'm looking back at it, they were actually able to maintain a culture that I don't think otherwise would have been possible if they came one or two at a time. So we have this foreign culture, this indelibly rich culture of Jewish people, of Yehudim, that are living in the foreign land. And that's what's evident when you read Megillat Esther from that perspective. It makes so much sense, because it's exactly part of the pattern of what Nebuchadnezzar was doing, picking people up and exiling them. And the leadership structure, big, important people are there. Now it's not strange when we look at Mordechai and we see, oh, you know, he wasn't a neb, he was a really important guy. And and that's why he was in position to really make things happen. Okay, so we're in, now, all right, a few years later, in 457 BCE, Ezra Sofer leads the Aliyah. All right, he's given a royal edict from King Artaxasta. Artaxerxes is the English name that everybody has for him. All right, this is after Koresh, who was the original Cyrus the Great, who was originally gave the edict that everybody can go back. He's gone, and now his successor is Artaxerxes, who's I think he's the son of Xerxes the First, which would make him the son of Ahasuerus. Okay, so if you want to like think about what possible influences that this guy actually had. He might have had a nice Jewish girl for a stepmom. Okay. So we're in Ezra Perek Zayin. V'zeh parshegen, that word sound familiar to everybody? V'zeh parshegen ha'ishtavan asher natana melech artashachta le'ezra ha'kohen asofer sofer divrei mitzvot Hashem v'chukav la'Yisrael. This is the edict, this is the letter that was written by Artashasta to Ezra. Artashasta melech ma'afiyah le'ezra ha'anasa fardatar, you can read in English. Basically, Ezra's allowed to go up, take anybody that he wants. Not only that, but we're going to fund him. We're going to fund this project. So this is the Persian Empire now declaring that they are going to fund the Aliyah of Ezra and anybody who wants to go with him, and they are going to fund the building of the Beit HaMikdash. But what's more, we get an even more stern commitment from him, from Artaxasta, a few years later, when Nehemiah goes. All right, this is the Nehemiah Perek Bet. All right, and this is about 10 years later. We're in source 8 right now, on page 2. Right, the 20th year of Artaxasta. Yain Lefanov, right? Does that sound familiar to you? Nehemiah was his cupbearer. He was his saramashki. So the king said to Nehemiah, Madua panecha ra'im, yata'in chachole, you're not sick, why are you so sad? And he responds in Pasuk Gimel, Va'omer lamelech, Hamelech le'olam yichya, you should live forever. Madua lo yeru panai, why shouldn't I be sad? Asher ha'ir beit kivrot avotai charivau she'era u'kalu ba'ish. All right, this is very, very vivid language that Nehemiah is saying here, describing what the Eretz Yisrael in Churban looks like. And you read the rest of source number 8. Artaxasta now not only has funded Ezra's campaign, but he funds Nehemiah's campaign as well, and he gives them a royal order to go to the lumber suppliers in Eretz Yisrael, which is now a province of the Persian Empire, to build the Beit HaMikdash. So this is a good time to be, to be a Jew. Now, think about it. What's different? You tell me. Artaxasta, the emperor, the leader of the Persian Empire, has now, as a general policy of religious tolerance, of keeping subjects devoted by allowing them to do whatever they want in terms of worship, he has now allowed Ezra and Nehemiah to go lead a delegation of people to go back, and he's willing to fund their aliyah and to fund the building of the Beis HaMikdash. What's different now than there was before, during the time of Bayis Rishon? What do you think?
You're beholden to a
Yeah. This is not like the independent Malchut Yehuda, which was paying tribute. This was, that had a long history of independence. This was a, from the get-go, from the first moment of the Aliyah of Ezra and Nehemiah, they are now a province. They are a part of the Persian Empire. Now, the only thing that is guaranteed to them is religious freedom. Now, that's a big deal. But this is a completely, you know, Elliot, on the point that I was saying before, if you're talking about the political nature of Am Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael, this is light years different than where we were during Bayis Rishon. Okay? So, we didn't talk about the good years of Bayis Rishon, about David and Shlomo, and about how, you know, when the Malchus was expanded. That, we all know that. But even towards the end, when things were lousy, this is a very, very different feel to it. And in fact, we know, right, which is famous, so we can talk about it, about how there only very few people came back with Ezra. So, it was a very lackluster effort to come back. Now, it is within this context that Chazal are born. Okay. That's why I wanted to spend half the shiur today talking about this. Because it is in this context that Chazal are born. The immediate precursors to Chazal were known as what?
The prophets.
Right. Now, between the prophets and Chazal. Moshe kibal Torah b'Sinai, Masar al Yeshua, Yeshua is the kingdom of the Levim, Levim le? Anshe Knesset Sagadola. The Anshe Knesset Sagadola are the earliest halachic authorities cited in Chazal. Alright? And the who was Mishiare Anshe Knesset Sagadola? Nope. Mordechai was part of the Anshe Knesset Sagadola, but Shimon HaTzadik. Shimon HaTzadik is the first. Think about Pirkei Avos. We're going to get back to these Mishnayos. Pirkei Avos is a fascinating piece of Chazal's literature. Because it's not only there to teach us moral lessons, but it's actually giving us a chronological order of the development of the Masorah. And it's very concerned with that. You see, it goes from teacher to student to teacher to student to teacher to student, starting from Moshe Rabbeinu. Shimon HaTzadik was the last of the members of the Anshe Knesset Sagadola. Now, the Anshe Knesset Sagadola might be the most important, I was talking about this with Michael last week, they might be the most important tkufa, the most important period in history in terms of what our religion looks like today.
Well, Shimon HaTzadik was the first or the last?
The last. He was Mishiare. He was from the remnant. Okay? And why am I saying that? Because it was the time of the Anshe Knesset HaGadola that halacha, as we know, it started to take shape for the first time. And I'll illustrate that by pointing to source number 9. All right? Well, let's read the English, because I didn't put these sources in, but I cited them. This is the period of the Anshe Knesset HaGadola. The governing religious council during the early Second Temple period comprised of 120 members, including the last of the prophets. What took inspiration from that 120 members? Anybody know? Knesset. The Israeli Knesset. Nakamat HaMedina. I got tear up when I think about this. The Israeli Knesset, when they were in Hakamat HaMedina and they're trying to develop their legislative body, they wanted to have a large legislative body so that there was a lot of room for a lot of opinions. But they needed to pick a number. So they didn't pick 120 out of nowhere. They modeled it after the Anshe Knesset HaGadola. It gives me the chills. So there's 100, it made up 120 members, including the last of the prophets. Members of the Anshe Knesset HaGadola included Ezra, Nehemiah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, Mordechai. All right? These are all members of the Anshe Knesset HaGadola. This body is responsible for a number of enduring changes to Jewish life, including the final determination of the biblical canon, all right? The Gemara in Bava Basra says that they determined, meaning all of the last Sfarim of Tanakh that went in and the ones that were not allowed in, they've made that determination. Establishment of the holiday of Purim, okay? They were establishing holidays. Brachos, Tfilos, Kedushos, Havdolos. Most of the Birchos HaNenim, the Birchos HaMitzvah that we have today that are taken as a given in Chazal were established by the Anshe Knesset HaGadola. The majority of the important parts of our Nusach HaTfilah, all right, the Shemona Esrei, established by the Anshe Knesset HaGadola. Changing the script of the Torah to Ksav Ashuris, that's number 4. It used to be a completely different script that the Hebrew was written in. And they changed it to, all of these are a longer discussion, but it was Akilu, it was the vernacular. And 5, they were restoring the people's observance of Shabbos, or the Gemara in Shabbos says that was numero uno, that they needed to, basically rekindle that flame. Now think about it. What are the Anshe Knesset HaGadola responsible for? They're responsible for Shul, right? They're responsible for davening. They're responsible for Shabbos. They're responsible for holidays. What is Yiddishkeit to us if not these things? This is all, the kernel of this was all happening in time of the Anshe Knesset HaGadola. Now, when I say that it's the most important time in Jewish history, one of the most important times in terms of what Judaism looks like today, it's made that much more interesting by the fact that we know virtually nothing about them. There's basically, you know, 15 to 20 citations, maybe more than that, 30, around the Gemara, and then some of the Medrash HaHalacha also, but we know virtually nothing about them. We don't know how they worked. The little snippets are really just scraps. Now this is a body that you see. I put them here. The Antik Knesset HaGedolah was first convened in the Aliyah of Ezra in 457, and they lasted until 210. Right, so that is a 250 year period, and it's one of the most important 2.5 centuries in our people's history, and we know virtually nothing about them. And then the only we're not going to get to it today, but the only thing that I think can rival that measure of influence, ironically, we also know virtually nothing about, is the Stama'im, the people that sealed the text of the Talmud Bavli. Right? They're the only ones that I think can give the Antik Knesset HaGedolah a run for their money, but I don't think, I honestly don't think it comes close, but we happen to not know anything about them either. Okay.
Did you say the Antik Knesset HaGedolah actually reinvented Judaism?
I do not think that at all. And I don't want anybody to go away thinking that they reinvented it.
I mean, beforehand, there was no concept of synagogue. There was no idea of really tefillah except for Greek Kabbalists.
No, there was tefillah. What there wasn't was nusach tefillah. All right, the Rishonim talk about how there was a mitzvah d'oraisa of tefillah. We had a Torah Shebaal Peh. I think everybody whoever's listening to this recording, we believe in Torah Shebaal Peh. Okay. There was a Torah Shebaal Peh long before there was an Antik Knesset HaGedolah, right? Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai. This was going on, but everybody, no, all right. This is in the debates over the history of halacha, right? And this was a hugely debated topic with the burgeoning of the conservative and reform movements in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. It was what the character of that halacha was, right? So they'll argue that the halacha was fossilized with the Antik Knesset HaGedolah with Chazal, when it was supposed to be a much more fluid system. Now we know, all right, and this is what makes us Orthodox Jews, right? The basic tenet of what makes orthodoxies is that we believe that Chazal were doing something divine. They had the divine hand involved in what they were doing. That makes what they were doing binding. That makes it significant. That's what's different between we might even look at the same development historically, but we'll say that we believe that God was behind it, and other people don't. And that's why there is that type of debate. Be that as it may. So Antik Knesset HaGedolah are creating all of these edicts that are starting to form Judaism into something that looks like more what we're familiar with. What happens in 210 BC? 210 BC, the reason that we close the period of Antik Knesset HaGedolah then is because that's when Shimon HaTzadik dies. And he's the last member of the Antik Knesset HaGedolah. Now, I put here, right, and this is the birth of Chazal, so the next page is really important in terms of understanding this history. Source number 10, on the bottom of 2 still, right, this is Shimon HaTzadik. The Mishnayos of the first parak, or the entire parak, specifically the first parak, goes through these histories. Shimon HaTzadik Haya, this is the second Mishnah, Haya Mishyari Knesset HaGedolah. Hu Haya Omer, Ashlosh Dvarim HaOlam Omid, Ala Torah, V'Ala Avoda, V'Ala Milus Chasadim. Alright, if this was Tzidkiyahu HaMelech, who was writing the three things that the world rests on, you think he would have said that? Maybe he would have said, foreign control, maybe he would have said, savvy politics, maybe he would have said...
But that's a response. The Pirkei Avos is like a spiritual response to the empire.
I completely agree with you, but listen to the language of Shimon HaTzadik, and this is why I think when you see it in this historical context, it's glaring. What does he say? Ashlosha dvarim ha'olam omein. If you wanted to talk about three tenets of religious life, don't you think you could have found a little bit more specific way, or a little less general way to talk about them? The world rests on three things. It used to rest for us on military strength, on a strong foreign policy, on a good fiscal policy. Now it rests on internal religious factors, matters. Torah, Avodah, and Gemilut Chasadim. How we care about each other, how we are involved in Talmud Torah, how we are involved in worship. Now we're still in Bayis Sheni time here, right? This is 200 years now that we've been Bayis Sheni. Yeah.
Is Act of Kindness a reference like the Cyrus allowing the return?
I don't think so. To make him be talking about Koresh was 250 years after it happened. I think when I read it, first of all, I read it because I think that HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe at Har Sinai, and this was part of the Masorah, that it's really important that we be good to each other. And that is manifest in a lot of mitzvos. That's not. I don't think he's making this up. But the point that I'm trying to make is that it's a question of points of emphasis. what he's emphasizing here is not something that is new to Judaism. What it is it's a newly formed emphasis. You understand what I'm saying? So the emphases used to be much more global, much more political. But now it's a completely different Weltanschauung.
It's almost like a return to religion. Before, he believed in your own power and might to be able to help you create yourself an independent state.
Yep.
Now you're saying, oh, maybe it's in God's hands and you should just go up and follow the world and help people.
All right. I would say the same thing, but a little bit differently. I mean, and I'm not right, and you're not right. It's like just different ways of looking at it. I would say that they were proven to be utter failures at the political activity, right? And it just got them into trouble. So now they want to say, all right, let's do life the way that we can. We have this great Persian Empire that's allowing us. Now, this is a very big period. A lot. Some of the most important things in the history of human existence happened in this period. Does anybody want to venture a guess? All right.
Greek Empire.
332 BCE. Greek Empire, led by
Alexander
of Macedonia.
Alexander
right.
The Great.
Alexander the Great. All right. There is several Mamari Chazal and a Tosefta. There's a Gemara in Yuma that says the Shimon HaTzadik actually met Alexander the Great as he was marching through. And as is the case with many Mamari Chazal, foreign leaders, even when they're bad guys, when they meet these sagacious Nevi'im or big members of Chazal, all of a sudden they become very taken by them. And so says the Gemara in Yuma, that in the middle of this line over here, Shimon HaTzadik actually met Alexander the Great. So what that meant. All right, and the reason why they're doing this, and I think why Chazal are saying this, whether it did or didn't happen, I have no reason to believe that it didn't, even though lots of people say it didn't. But what that did was they were justifying why there was such a good, fair, kind, and tolerant policy in the Greek Empire for the Jewish people. Now that all changed. That all changed in. I'll give you the exact date. It all changed in 322 BC. 322 BC is when Alexander of Macedonia suddenly dies at a very young age, and the empire can't sustain itself. And that is when the world starts to unravel again. All right? Basically, what happens is that he's got this big, he's got the, one of the largest empires in the history of the world, and he has four generals, and the four generals who are vying each to succeed Alexander the Great, they end up splitting up the empire. Okay? And our boy, Antiochus, all right, ends up being the successor of one of the people that takes over that region of Syria and Judea from Alexander the Great, and he has a much different attitude towards the Jews. Yeah.
So maybe that point in time there's a chashash, there's a suspicion that maybe the Jews will go back into the political game to protect themselves.
All right. So why they did it is a good question. We have to talk. We have to talk about it. But let's zip through page 3. Page 3 is now when we're getting into hardcore Chazal. Okay? Keep in mind the dates that we're talking about. 175 BCE, we're on the top. After Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, right? The Antiochus of the Pachanica story is known as Antiochus IV, Epiphanes. He takes the throne of the Seleucid Empire. That was the quarter of the Alexandrian Empire that he is occupying. What happens? It ends up being the Jewish people that get involved in politics again. And that is what spells their downfall. Jason, the brother of Onan. Okay, well, I should give a disclaimer. What do we know about the Kohanim Gedolim during the time of Bais Sheni?
It was up for sale.
It was up for sale, right? That's the Gemara in Yuma actually famously says that there was only like 20 in the entire period of Bais Rishon. There was only 20 Kohanim Gedolim, and in the relatively equal amount of number of years going through the time of Bais Sheni, there was over 300 Kohanim Gedolim. Am I getting those numbers right? I think so. All right. So it was up for sale. There was backstabbing. People who actually weren't Kohanim were getting the kahuna. All right. So it was a very corrupt system. At that time, all right, during that time, that's when the Sanhedrin kind of takes on a whole new function. Until Shimon HaTzadik, during the entire time of the Antiochus HaGadola, the kahuna gadola is basically the political leader of the Jewish people. It's the religious leader and the political leader. Shimon HaTzadik is the last person to be a Kohen Gadol and a Av Beis Din. After Shimon HaTzadik, the whole system changes. Now, basically, the Beis Din, and the Av Beis Din allows the Kahuna to remain corrupt, and the Beis Din basically is the religious functionary of the people, that starts kind of operating independently. So all the trouble that the Jewish people get into is because of the Kahuna Gadola. What happens? All right, we're in source number four. I'm quoting here from Maccabees, which is one of the Apocrypha. Right, it's Svarim written by Jews intended to go into Tanakh, but the Ashkenaz Gadola did not allow them. So right, they were, it's because the Tanakh was closed. So there's Maccabees 1, Maccabees 2, I'm quoting from 2 Maccabees over here. So Antiochus Epiphanes, who is the Antiochus of the villain of the Hanukkah story, tries to get bought out by this guy Jason. Jason, who's the Kohen Gadol, right? Yason, I think is how he's spelled in Hebrew. His older brother is the Kohen Gadol. He now offers a big payout to Antiochus if he says, all right, you're the ruling power now here. If you get my brother out and you put me, install me as the Kohen Gadol, then I can, then I'll pay you a lot of money. And that's what happens. All right, this is source 11. Later, when King Seleucus died, and Antiochus, known as Epiphanes, became king, right, Seleucus was the successor to Alexander the Great, Antiochus takes over for him. Jason, the brother of Onias, right, that's Chonio, is his Hebrew name, became high priest by corrupt means. He went to see the king and offered him 20... This book was originally written in Hebrew. We don't have the Hebrew version, we only have the Greek version, which is why putting it in the Hebrew version is just a translation anyway, which is why I just put it in English. Right, he went to see the king and offered him 27,000 pounds of silver, with 6,000 more pounds to be paid later. Jason also offered him an additional 11,250 pounds of silver for the authority to establish a stadium where young men could train and enroll the people of Jerusalem as citizens of Antioch. Okay, so Jason, the Kohen Gadol, buys the priesthood, which is not, unfortunately, not all that rare during this period of history. And what the problem was that rather than keeping the politics internal, he goes to the ruling power and says, all right, you'll get rich off of me. I have this big storeroom, and Maccabees actually records this. He takes from the kelim of the Beis HaMikdash, the gold, the klei hazav of the Beis HaMikdash, in order to pay off Antiochus. And that's what happened. That's how it all starts. All right, that's source number four. Getting to source number five, all right, Antiochus now has this vassal Kohen Gadol, this vassal ruler, again, same pattern, who's now living in Judea, right? And he's the Kohen Gadol, this guy, Jason. And then what happens, he's told that there's an attack on Jerusalem, and basically there's a lot of infighting. So what Antiochus then does is his vassal Kohen Gadol gets ousted. You can't cross him, so he marches on Yerushalayim and tries to reinstall the vassal Kohen Gadol. All right, now that is what triggers the internal strife in amongst the Jews at the time. They're now being oppressed by a foreign ruler. A foreign army is now on their soil, and Antiochus' plan, which is we all know, this is the Hanukkah story. Antiochus' plan was, in order to keep these people in check, I got to take their religion away. So we're going to Hellenize them. What was the process of Hellenization? It was the thought that if we could get everybody in the world under the same religion, then well, everybody will finally just be able to get along. So the thought was, all right, let's change this god that the Jewish people are worshiping. We'll just change his name to Zeus, and then now everybody's worshiping the same god. Now, he didn't realize what a terrible idea that was because of the long history of anti-idolatrous attitudes that we have in our people. So it does not work well. Some people want to be Hellenized, but Matisyahu and the Hashmonaim famously rebel against this. And Matisyahu, he kills somebody publicly. If everybody, if you're ever interested, you really should read 1 Maccabees and 2 Maccabees. There's a very explicit telling of these stories. Matisyahu raises this rebel army. His son, Yehuda HaMaccabee, ends up taking over. And they muster this big force, and they actually beat back. Right, and this is why this was the Rabbi Miyad Miyatim, Tfeyam Miyatar, Mishar Miyat Sadikim, Zaydi Biyaska, Odis Kesar Asecha. This was a religiously zealous army. And they raised themselves up, and they beat back one of the most powerful armies in the world. All right, so that we celebrate this mace is not a coincidence. It really was a shocking miracle.
They also beat back all those Hebrews who were Hellenized.
Yeah, and they did that too. And in the process, they cleansed not only the land from foreign rule, but they cleansed themselves. That's why this is such an important watershed moment in the history of Bayashim.
But it's also noteworthy that it was the Kohanim that fought. It was the religious people that fought.
Yeah, that's what I said. So it was religiously zealous people. Okay, we're not going to, all right, apparently this is my theme, we're not going to have time to get through everything here, but just very quickly, take a look here. I have the dates, and this period All going right. 166 BCE is the Hanukkah story. All right, that's when all this is happening. And could read source 13 when you get a chance. All right. Now the green boxes are all these are all the members of Chazal. After you get away from Shimon HaTzadik, we have the period of what's known as the Zugot. Right, the pairs. That's the pair of the Av Beis Din and the Nasi. The Nasi is the head, basically the head of the Sanhedrin, and the Av Beis Din is the second in command. This is the religious power structure in Am Yisrael at the time, in the Yehuda at the time. And these are all names that we now all start to recognize. These are names with halachic opinions that come up in the Mishnah and the Gemara. All right. Source number four. Is Yosef ben Yehuda Yisraida and Yosef ben Yochanan Yishu Yerushalayim. Right, this was the first. These were the inheritors of Shimon HaTzadik and Antignos Yishsocho. I didn't put Antignos here. All right, getting to source number 17. All right, and we're now they get Yeshua ben Prachya and Itay Arbeli. All right, they were the next zug. They were the next pair of Nasi and Abbeitin. All right, then going from there, we have. Now keep in mind what the dates that we're looking at here. 100 BC to 60 BC is the period of leadership of Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shetach. So that was the next zug. And then the next zug is the most famous of the zugot, and the last of them was Hillel and Shammai.
You no longer have the Kohen Gadol as.
So the Kohen Gadol is still in place. There is still a Bayis Sheni. There's still an Avoda. There's still sacrifices going on. But the Sanhedrin starts to function like much more of an independent body. And now think about it. This is the time that the Mishnah is starting to be written. Okay, now it doesn't achieve its full form until centuries later when you review the Nasi finally redacts it all. But this is the time. Look at these names. These are the people with concrete halachic opinions. Not all of them. Some of them we don't have so much from. But now we get to Hillel and Shammai. Right? We don't need to guess about what Hillel and Shammai were spending their days doing. We know. We have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of halachic opinions that they were sitting in a Beis Medrash working out. All right, so the world of Judaism now, in this period of time, is starting to take shape. It's starting to look a lot more similar to what we understand. People with a structure of Torah learning that's recorded, opinions are being recorded. Now, keep in mind what's going on in the wider world here. This is a corrupt political structure. Now, the Hashmonaim take over, and yes, we've now achieved political independence for the first time in centuries. And it lasts 100 years, but we know the history of the Hashmonaim. While it was a great miracle, the Nes Chanukah, it was really the beginning of the end. The monarchy of the Hashmonaim wasn't the Davidic monarchy, and it ends up devolving into nothing. And we get into the same problems that we got in with at the end of Bayis Sheni with Yehoyakim and Yehoyachin, that we got into with the Alexander of Macedonia's successors when they were trying to pay him off. We get into the same problems. But at this point in time, we have the Zugot, who, I would argue, for this reason, because of what's going on, have separated themselves from the pack of the Kahuna Gadola, and now are sitting there and learning, right, in the classical sense. Okay, that's where we are right now. So that brings us really to some very important times in history. Okay, what happens now as we're approaching the what is now the big world power that's developing as we are approaching the Common Era?
Rome.
This is the rise of the Roman Empire, and it coincides with the period of Mishnayot. If anybody's interested in ancient history, you gotta know Chazal. This is a rich, extremely literate people that were writing a ton at the time of one of the most pivotal moments in history of the rise of the Roman Empire, and they were right smack in the middle of it all. So it's really crazy. Now the orange things that I put here, all right, that is the periods of resistance. Okay, or the first one's not. I don't know why that one. I made that one orange. But you see, 37 BC to 4 BC, what happens there? That's the period of Herodus, of Herod the Great. Back up a little bit. I just 63 BCE is the most important date for the Roman Empire. Pompey the Great, consul of the Roman Republic, after conquering the Pontic Kingdom, modern-day Turkey, is asked to intervene in a civil war in Judea over the Hasmonean monarchy, and that intervention is what makes Yehuda, after 100 years of the rule of the Hashmonaim, that's what puts us under the boot of Rome. Okay? So now, for the first time in 100 years, we are subservient to a foreign power again. That's 63 BC. Now, coinciding with that is the leadership of Yehuda ben Tabai and Hillel and Shammai and Shmaya ben Athaliah. Right? Hillel was Hillel grew up. Or this is recorded. Hillel grew up as a not knowledgeable person living in the country. He came to learn in the yeshiva of Shmaya ben Athaliah, who were his ultimate predecessors, the people who he succeeded in the end. Right? They were his rebbein. So the history of this is right there. It's right there for us to appreciate. And you see what's going on in the world when this is happening. Okay. I'm going to skip this because I really want to get to the end and the last few minutes to read something. Rav Soloveitchik, I think, frames this in a really important way. But everybody understand how I made this timeline? Everybody's following it? Good. So you can do self-study for the rest of it. The Chachmei Mishnah, I should meant to say this at the beginning, the Chachmei Mishnah is what I was going to limit it to. Everybody can turn to the back page. Alright, let me mention one point. Right? I put the same pie chart that I did last week over here of the mitzvot. This is all, keep in mind, the Mishnah is being written at this point. As the grip on political independence and rule over, self-rule is slipping away more and more, that's when the writing of the Mishnah becomes more and more vigorous. Okay? Yehuda Anasi, who you'll see on page 4, redacted the Mishnah around the year 200, in the 190s, right? That's when he finished it, and that's when the shift to Babel actually happens, and then when the Talmud Bavli starts to be written by Rav and moves there, right? That's happening at a time where the political independence of the Jewish people are slipping away more and more. It's been 150 years since we've had a Beis Hamikdash. It's all gone now. And that's when the Mishnah starts to be written. I always thought that this was fascinating, that the amount of work that it must have taken to put together the Mishnah. The Mishnah is one of the only, it's one of, right, you'll come over to me afterwards if you know the other two. It's one of three comprehensive works on all of Torah Sheval Peh in the history of the Jewish people. All right, I'm not going to wait. Anybody know the other two?
Rambam's
the one, and much more contemporary. You have to count two, they were published separately. Two, what? Not the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch is very limited. Close to the Aruch HaShulchan. Rav Chiel Michal Levi Epstein wrote his sole second section of the Aruch HaShulchan is the Aruch HaShulchan HaAsiv, where he goes into all the sacrificial halachot. Only three works, and correct me, if anybody wants to come up with a different one, I'm interested. Those are the only three works I know of all time that do a comprehensive review, survey of all of Torah Sheval Peh. That was being done when we had no Mikdash. That was being done when we had no religious autonomy. We were under the boot of Rome, and that's when the Mishnah was being written. It's fascinating that as our fingers were slipping away from the control that we had over ourselves, that's when we found the need to put everything down in writing for the first time. And I think there was no more prescient, no more of a wise decision than that. Okay, very quickly, Rav Soloveitchik talking about something very different. Right? This is in his Sfir Drasha, so the Chamesh Drashot that he gave talking about religious Zionism. And he so poetically makes this point right now. I'm talking about something else that I wanted to use his words in order to make it. Right, the Gemara in Brachos, this is the source 23 on the back page. The Gemara in Brachos cites the famous story of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai on the eve of the Beit HaMikdash being destroyed, when Vespasian is encamped around Yerushalayim in the year 70. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai sneaks out of the city and meets Vespasian. And he does a little fancy footwork like the famous Jews who meet, foreign dictators always do. And, of course, he's very taken by him. And the way the Gemara in Gittin says that he was, that's the previous source, you can read it on your own. The Gemara in Gittin says that he was so taken with him that he said he's going to grant him a request. And what's the request that he makes? Yavne v'chachameha. And immediately, the Gemara then says that Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi Akiva were critical. He should have asked for a bigger piece of the pie. He should have asked for Yerushalayim to be spared. Now, Rav Soloveitchik, this is just bone-chilling how he puts this. He's talking about another Gemara in Brachos, about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and his deathbed. Years and years later, after this event, when he, right, what was Yavne v'chachameha? Why were we able to write the Mishnah over the 150 years after the Churban? It's because of this decision. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked for the Chachamim of Am Yisrael to remain. And the Gemara says in Brachos that at his deathbed, he uses this language that it seems to be that he really regretted something, that there was something out there that he was really not sure about. So let's skip to the third paragraph. Kasher Aspasianus Kesar Pana La Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. When Vespasian saw Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Ela boi minei midach diasam lach. I'll do whatever you want. Ana Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai miyad tin li yavna vechachamel. Seferes HaGemara, the Gemara says, when he asked for Yavna and its scholars, the Gemara says that Rabbi Yosef, V'isev Rabbi Akiva, Meshin Chachamim Achar Radatam Yisakel, that they might have been making a big mistake. We're in the middle of the third paragraph. Ibari le lemeimar le l'shavkinu hadazimna. You should have asked for a bigger thing. You should have asked for all of Jerusalem. Halo yachol haya levakesh atzalat Yerushalayim v'beit hamikdash. What could have happened? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai could have asked for the whole Beis Hamikdash. V'hagemara mosifa l'saper, ki Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai chashav b'sha'at ma'aseh, b'sha'at ma'aseh, dilma kulei hay lo avid v'hatzala purta nami lo haveh. I can't ask for too much. He's given me a window here. And if I ask for too much, if I ask for Yavna and Yerushalayim, he might give me nothing. B'milim acherot, says the Rav. This is beautiful. Bakasha gedola kazo, we're in the fourth paragraph. This big of a request, katzalat Yerushalayim, haya aspasianus doche. Right? This great of a request he was gonna deny. Kasha ama yudi haya mafsid et shneim. And if he was gonna deny it, they would have lost out both. Gamat Yerushalayim, the gamat Chachmei Yavna. Et hachra'a hazot, haya al Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai lasot toch daka achat. He had a moment to make this decision when Vespasian asked him, what do you want? A moment. Ha'achlata ha'ita aspasionus yagiv al-ota ha'bakasha shalatzat Yerushalayim. What was his question? Is Vespasian going to grant me the request if I ask for Yerushalayim? Ha'sheila ha'ita she'ila chamura. This question that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked himself was an important one. Ulay ha'sheila ha'chamura b'yoter b'toldot Yisrael. Maybe the most important question asked in all of Jewish history. Ulay ha'sheila ha'chamura b'yoter b'toldot Yisrael. V'lifsok ota ha'yatzarich Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai ba'atzmo. He had to just make the decision on his own. Lelo ha'teyotzot im chaverav. He couldn't ask for advice from his friends. He was by himself. Toch kidei dibur. In a moment's notice. Memela me'olam lo haya batuach im hichriya nachon. And on his deathbed, he's not sure if he chose correctly. Mitzad echad nidmelo. On the one hand, it seemed to him, ki yachol haya lahashpia al aspasyanus sheyatzil at Yerushalayim. Maybe it would work if I asked for Jerusalem. Kefi shechashu Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi Akiva, just like the other Tanaim thought. Libo shatat dam al shelo bikesh et zeh. At the end of his life, he's agonized that we're not having chosen to ask that question. Me'idach kisa, on the other side of the coin, chashafu, asur haya la'amid b'safek, Sakana et Chachmei Yavna ve'Atar Shebal Peh. I can't allow the Chachamim of Yavna for the world of Torah Shebal Peh to be b'safek, to be at risk for a moment. In kol kedushato v'chashivuto shel Beit HaMikdash, kiyum ha'oma einenu taluy bo. Because as important as the Beit HaMikdash is, the world, the Jewish people can get on without a Beit HaMikdash. Ulam, the lo Torah Shebal Peh, without the Torah Shebal Peh, lo tuchal ha'oma leitkayem af l'zman kach. It can't exist for a moment without the Torah Shebal Peh. We've seen that we can live without political and autonomous rule. We cannot live without Torah. Ma gadol hayat tzaaro. How great was the pain? Kama agmat nefesh sava. How much anguish did he feel? Kama leilot nidilei shena. How many sleepless nights? This is so poetic, the way the Rav portrays this. V'imei atzav avru alav. Days of anguish, days of sadness that passed over him in his life. Al Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Akav ha-safek hazeh, ekev ha-safek hazeh, kasheh lanu nisha'er. It's hard for us to imagine how difficult him dealing with this decision for the rest of his life was. Ragaim ha-achronim shel chayav, kasher nifrad mitalmidav, in the last moments of his life, when his talmidim left the room, hidgish, kil midvad ha-kol, yareihu b'miyuchad mehadin. When push comes to shove, he was terrified of being judged. The cheshbon she'alav yihyeh latit laHakadosh Baruch Hu al ha'achra'a habilti nachon al ha'achra'a b'she'ila zu, and his decision on this question. Hayu shnei drachim ha'achad nachon ha'sheni habilti nachon. The first was the correct way, and one way was not the correct way. Ha'achad movil l'gan Eden. One leads to paradise. Ha'sheni l'gehinom. The third leads to the depths of hell. Ulam ein yilud ha'isha. Now this is very poetic. The flesh and blood, the person who was given birth to by a woman, yachol adat b'nogei al ha'achrot ka'ela. These weighty decisions or it's unknowable what the outcome is going to be. Im halach b'derech hayashar olam. And then Rav Soloveitchik ends, because this was the point of his drasha, saying, if Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, the great Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, knew how to doubt himself, could doubt himself on such an important question and such an important decision, which, by the way, we can attribute the existence of Klal Yisrael today to that decision. Like you said, one of the most important decisions ever. How much more so us to not be so confident? Now, that, my point here is not that we should be that we shouldn't be so confident in ourselves. My point is to read, because the Rav just very poetically portrayed how important this decision was. Torah Sheval Peh was born out of this history that we went over this morning. It was born out of this difficulty with never being able to get autonomous rule, never being able to handle it. And as we transitioned away from there, what sustained Am Yisrael, what nobody will ever doubt, is the Torah Sheval Peh that was born, that was sustained on that very day with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And when we've come back in the 20th century to Shivat Zion, you know, this is, the debate is ongoing. To what extent is it necessary for us to be a halachic people? And, you know, the contours of the debate has changed very, very much over the last 7 years. But the debate is still ongoing. And we, you know, it's not a secret about where we stand on this question. But, the only tefillah in the spirit of Hanukkah, and in the spirit of so much of the anguish and pain that this history of Am Yisrael has shown us, but so much also of the promise and potential, it's that, you know, all of Am Yisrael realizes the centrality, the need, the importance, and the significance of Am Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael, but of course with the Torah Yisrael at its core. Shkoch.